I'm Nick Ristad, and I've worked in the prison system as a chaplain for 17 years full-time, and really have been involved in prison ministry for almost 30 years since I was in the seminary. I started my prison work by sheer accident at San Quentin Prison when I was at the Lutheran Seminary in Berkeley, getting ready to leave the Lutheran Seminary because I thought there was just too much bullshit for me to deal with at that point. And so I bumped into what was then called clinical pastoral training or clinical training. And that was not recommended by the seminary at the time. It was something that they were really, in one sense, trying to suppress. This was back in 1960. And I went over to San Quentin and was over there, and went over there with much protest, too. I didn't think I wanted to do that even. And got over there and discovered that within a week that that's exactly where I belonged, that I understood exactly what was going on, not exactly, but I understood those men, and I understood what prison was about, and I particularly understood the violent men. Every prison has a prison of the prison, where the men in the prison who can't get along and who kill and rape and maim people are put. And that was the place where I gravitated to do my ministry and discovered that it was just a very exciting place for me to be. And I love being there. And then geared myself to go into prison ministry. Some of you may know in the Lutheran Church, you are not allowed, or in those days you were not allowed, I don't know what the regulations of the new church are, to take a parish. Is it all right if I sit down, or would you rather have me stand up? Can you hear me all right?
Yeah.
Not allowed to take a parish until you are allowed to take any chaplaincy work until you've been in the parish for 3 years. So I geared myself then to, and looked forward to the parish, and went into the parish and went into a poor white Chicano black parish in Fresno, California. And some of my people were in prison and juvenile hall and that kind of thing, so I just kind of carried on from there. And then I helped the Salvation Army set up a halfway house for ex-convicts in Los Angeles, did a lot of therapy work, group counseling, that kind of stuff. Trying to think what other things I've done. I've been on the State Advisory Committee for chaplains for the last 15 years. Was president of the state chaplains in California for a while. I'm a CPE supervisor. That probably doesn't mean anything to you who aren't clergy people. I have interns that come and train with me and have done that for 22 years and did most of that was not when I all that when I was in prison mainly. Now I'm a chaplain at mental hospital at Napa. If you know anything about wine, you know where Napa is. And now Napa is opening up for 300 men from the former prison that I worked at to come in. So I'm continuing with that work. And that's part of the reason why they selected me to become chaplain at Napa, I think, when I competed for that job. I worked at Vacaville, which is a prison mental hospital, and there were three of those hospitals in the world. There are mental hospitals in prisons, but there was never a prison set up specifically for psychiatric care, and Vacaville was set up specifically for that. The only other two was Butner, which the government has changed into a full prison now, Butner in South Carolina, and one in England. And I was particularly interested in therapy with convicts, and so it was a very exciting place for me to be for the first 15 or maybe 12 years, and then we became overcrowded, and the therapy staff just exited quickly. When I came there were 1,400 men. When I left, there were 3,500 in the same prison, and we had people living in hallways and that kind of business. So that's a little bit of my background. There's lots of other things I did too, but that's kind of irrelevant at this point. The struggle of our community, our country, for understanding prison is tragic. we don't seem to have any alternatives emotionally to deal with people who offend us, except to take revenge and to lock them up. I don't know if any of you, have any of you here had been assaulted or robbed or anything like that? I have. I mean, I've had it happen to me after I've been involved in this work. I've had my house, two separate homes, broken into twice, and in one home, everything was almost taken, including stuff in the refrigerator. I had my car broken into and burned, and then I had stuff stolen out of my second home. If you've ever had that happen to you, it's a terrifying experience to come home to find that, and it usually happens at night, and it's terrifying to come in to find that happening, and then the anger and the rage that wells up inside you to be personally violated like that, and to have your personal belongings scattered all over the place, and sorting that out and finding out what's stolen, and then the things that they take and that are sometimes irreplaceable, heirlooms and that kind of stuff. It's not a pleasant experience. And then if you've been assaulted or have had somebody murdered in your family or your friend, that's even worse. It's an awful, you know, experience. Well, what do you do with people like that? And what is our attitude towards people like that? And our attitude basically is to hurt them and to kill them back. The original next year is the 200th anniversary of the Walnut Street Jail. The history of the prison system started, it's called the Grand American Experiment. And it started in Philadelphia, Walnut Street Jail, by Episcopalians, Lutherans, Presbyterians. I'm trying to think if there was some Baptist involved, and I'm not sure about that. And the Quakers. And the original understanding of that experiment was that they would take and put men in single cells, and they would work hard, and they would read the scripture, and the rehabilitation would take place in the silent meditation in the scripture and in the hard working. With the hope then that these men would become rehabilitated and be put out citizens again. That fairly quickly proved not to be a successful model. But we have stayed with that for up till now. It's still the model that we use. Before that, prisoners were just thrown in communal living situations where they were just all thrown together and treated very crudely and rudely. So we're celebrating the 200th anniversary of this Grand American Experiment this year, which has been a failure. I don't know if any of you have seen the PBS documentary by Tom Wicker called Monuments to Failure. I happened to catch it by accident, and then I called and tried to buy it and then decided it wasn't worth it. I guess it was $100 that they wanted for it, and I decided I wasn't going to get that. I think probably I will get that now because it keeps coming back to me, and the kinds of things that they're saying and doing are he points out very clearly, that, and interviews some of my friends and does some, it's a good documentary. The cost of this system that we have is just atrocious, and the crime of punishment, in one sense, is not so much the crime of punishment against the people that we put in prison, but against ourselves. So that when we're talking about the issue of justice, it's really an injustice that we're doing to ourselves. The biggest expenditure of tax dollars, aside from the defense budget, is corrections. Most people don't know that. When I came to the state of California as a chaplain in 1969, there were about 10,000 prisoners there. We were one of the biggest departments in the world at 10,000. Then, that was 1969. Today, I read in the U.S. News Today, on the way up here yesterday or the day before, the Department of California Department of Corrections has 83,000, which probably means there's 85,000 men in there. When I asked people in those days how much did they think that it cost to keep 10,000 men in prison a year and another 10,000 people on parole probably, the usual estimate I would get would be, well, probably somewhere between $50 and $100 million a year. And then I'd say, well, no, it costs $300 million a year. And now it costs almost $2 billion a year just for the state of California to keep people locked up. It costs
per person?
$2 billion.
How much per person is that roughly?
Well, it varies according to the kind of cell they're kept in. Some cells cost up to $50,000 and other barracks cost, you know, $1,000. So there, we have people that fight fires and they live out in camps. We have levels 1, which is the lowest, to 4, which is maximum security. And San Quentin is just now becoming a level 2 prison. It's not going to be maximum security any longer, as Folsom is going to become a level 3 prison.
So your total figure included the cost of the facility itself?
No, no, it's just cost. This is keeping people per year to keep these people. It doesn't cost the building of the prison.
Custodial care.
Yeah, that's just for the custodial care and the, you know, paying my salary and other people's salary. Well, I'm not in the Department of Corrections now. I'm in the Department of Mental Hygiene.
So how many women? You named how many men?
No, that includes the women. The women, I'm not quite clear about that, but it's not more than 3,000. Not more than 3,000. Because the women's prison down in Southern California is maximum down there is 1,500. It's built for about 800, and they've got 15, I think. Now, they may have 18. And the new one is just opening up in Stockton, and that has about, I think, 5 at this point. I'm not quite clear the numbers. I don't get those as regular as I used to. Now, this is just the state of California. I assume some of you are from other states, and there are other systems going on. But this is happening throughout the whole country, including the federal system. The state of California, I was involved in the planning for the 80s. In 1979 through 1980, I was working in central office in Sacramento, planning for the new prisons for the 80s, for the chaplains, because I was on the state advisory committee and I was also on the chaplains coordinating committee for the Department of Corrections. I was the Protestant representative there. So I was working in Sacramento planning for these new prisons to be built, and talking to the architects and planning for chapels and how we're going to run programs and that kind of thing. And at that point, we were planning to build 10 new prisons, and it's mushroomed from that to, I think, 20 new prisons. And at that point, we had 12 prisons. So we're talking about 35 prisons altogether, and they're just exploding. They're just building them all over the place. And I asked the architects, well, what does it cost to build one of these places? They said, well, average cost in that then was about $20 million. And the new prison that went up next to Vacaville started out at $20 million, and I think it ended up being about $50 million. So that the it just mushrooms just very quickly, telescopes out into expenses.
Have you broken that down, how that can work out per man?
Well, as I say, it can be up to as high as $25,000 a year to keep a man in prison.
Well, I mean, when you build the prison, when the cost of the prison itself cannot be broken down into how much that would cost per bed.
Well, again, it depends upon, for the whole system. If you're going to average it out for all the men, some of the men are living in barrack style, and some of the men are living in maximum security cells, and some of the men are on death row, and that all. So, I think we've got a. I know we've got a, at least 180 men on death row. There may be more. The average is somewhere between $15,000 and $25,000 a year to keep a man in prison, which is enough to send him to a good school. When what we're going to do about the escalating costs of this industry, I don't know. As long as we feel that we have to lock people up as the only alternative, as it's basically an emotional alternative that we're using. It's not a therapeutic or a economic or a rational alternative that we're using. It's an emotional alternative that we have. And it's an alternative that we all have and that we all use in one form or another. And one of the ways that we can gauge where we are about this is to watch what happens in the press. And then one of the ways you can gauge where you are in all this is watch your reaction to what you, how you feel about the latest crime that's reported in the press. The latest crime in California was, and maybe, I don't know where you're from, was the Salcedo incident where this grape worker went around and killed his family and killed a few other people on the way and then ran off to Mexico and was brought back. And the reaction to everybody was, kill him. Kill a son of a bitch. And as long as we have that reaction, then we have to have prisons to punish people in. Because, the other reaction that I think many of us know about is what happened to Jim Wright's right-hand man. We don't believe in forgiveness. If somebody does something and then something happens later on, we believe in continual punishment. So that there is no such thing as forgiveness for crime in our country. I don't know in other countries there are. I think there are. But in this country, there's no such thing as forgiveness for crime. Once you committed a crime, you pay for it for the rest of your life. And people are very happy to have that happen.
What's the prison clientele then that you're familiar with, what percentage of those would you say are, I mean, like, what is it like? Are some mentally unstable? Or how many did the crimes are out of passion and maybe a one-time thing? I mean, because where you're coming from, I think, presupposes a sense of that rehabilitation or of renewal that can take place. Yet others would say that there are certain people who are just institutionally inherently unfit
right.
for society. So how do you balance that?
Right. I can give you the statistics and information that I know about and what my experience tells me. The crimes break down into terms of robbery, where it's, you know, breaking and entering and no people involved. Then there's people crimes. People crimes are violence or in hold up kind of things. And then there's actual acting out on other people with stabbings and that kind of business. The statistics say pretty clearly that murderers are the best risk for non-repetitive kind of crime. Most murders occur between people who know each other, and many of them are familial, family kind of situations. And when I went to India, I went towards some of the prisons there, and I was asking them about this, and they said, "Oh yes, we know that about murderers, and we don't keep most murderers in prison for over 7 years. That's just inhuman. That's barbaric to keep murderers in prison because we understand that this is familial and this is volatile, and there's all these kinds of things that take place. So that's absolutely correct. We don't. Well, in this country, we don't even, that doesn't even occur to us. We." You know, the more emotion that we generate, the more publicity that we generate around a crime, the longer the term in prison is going to be for the person normally.
You talked about the forgiveness issue, and I'm wondering if there is any system, maybe in a different country that you know of, where there is an element of forgiveness and it's effective.
My understanding is that the Netherlands have a pretty good system.
In what ways? Or
I'm not directly familiar with, I'll tell you what I know about it, is that they don't believe in keeping anybody in prison or in confinement more than 18 months. And their parole system is all a voluntary parole system. That is, they it's people in the community who do the paroling. You and I volunteer to be parole people that take people and watch them and care for them. The history statistics say that if you go into the hospital and you're in there for 3 weeks, when you come out back to your family has a difficult adjustment accepting you back into the family milieu, and there's going to be some adjustment problems. The history has also said clearly that if you lock a man up for more than 18 months and you bring him, his maximum gain is made within 18 months, and after 18 months he deteriorates. And then if you bring him out back into society, he's got a tremendous adjustment and lots of rejection going on. So that's just a simple, you know, exit entry kind of process that goes on. If you look at that clearly, you can see then most of our average length of stay in prison is somewhere around 3 years or more. So we create our own problems.
Are you in favor then of the new parole system whereby a person is monitored once he's let out? Electronically monitored,
yeah.
I understand it is.
That's really a new viable option. That there are pros and cons about that, and it has to do with your understanding of humankind and what humankind is and how we feel about one another. And is it permissible in this electronic age for us to bug each other? And where are the civil liberties? And the thing that we forget is that when we pass a law to control somebody, that law is also going to be used against us. And what kind of a society do we want to live in? Or do we want to live in a police state? Or don't we? And then what kind of choices are we going to make about the freedom that we have within that and those parameters? So those are all trade-offs. Some people are using it supposedly successfully, but where do you stop with that? When do you start monitoring other kinds of things?
Is there any feedback from that yet, from the released prisoners themselves? Because I think it would be very demeaning to have to wear something like this, but maybe it's better than being locked up.
It sounds, the little information that I have, maybe some of you have more information than I do.
I have a friend of mine who's a police officer, and he said that worked for about 2 weeks. And the person with the thing on his leg gets so bugged by it that he just breaks it to get rid of it. He just should go back in the slammer and carry that thing around, even though he's out, because he has to be in at 7 o'clock. It's almost like a little kid.
Mm-hmm.
They tell him you're out, and then they say you can't go here and you can't go there, and you got to be here at 7 o'clock, and if you're not, we're going to come and get you and drag you back. And so when they go to get these guys, they're waiting for him.
Yeah.
You take this thing off my leg? Yeah, okay, fine, take me back. Let's go get it over with. The thing that disturbs me, at least in Ohio, is we've got two screwed laws. If they pick you up having any marijuana, and in some counties the judges have nothing else to do but give out 5-year terms. And they do.
Mm-hmm.
Or drunken driving now is mandatory sentence in the state. And the people of the prisons are just beside themselves. And the whole state of Ohio locked up.
That's right. That's right.
And the politicians do not want to build their prisons. And so you've got these people that are technically being punished, but they're really not. They get to go and do whatever they darn well please.
Well, that's the other issue. We can get into the whole issue of what punishment is about and why punishment is not a deterrent and what that means. That's a whole other issue. And then we can get into the whole theological issue of who are we as a religious community, and what is our attitude about this, and where does that attitude come, and the whole history behind that. I can do that for you too. And then we can get into the history, and I brought some stuff along that I'd be willing to hand out and give to you. What kind of people go to prison? Psychopaths, sociopaths. Who are these people? What does it mean to be this kind of a person? And then I brought a tape along that was done. I don't know if any of you saw 48 Hours last week, Dan Rather's thing, and they did that on Napa State Hospital. They did a lot of that, and some of my parishioners are in there. And what's the impact of the prison system on the mental hospital system and vice versa? Because there's a real correlation. And then the street people. We can get into some of that. And then if you want to go into what is ministry to these kinds of people, we can get into that issue. That's a whole other issue on top of that. And then the whole political thing on top of that. So there's this whole gamut of things that we can explore that I can help you explore if you're interested in doing that in the next 3 or 4 days, or if you're just, you know, bored with all of it, that's fine. It's been typical of my experience of talking about prison ministry that it's a volatile experience for a lot of people, that there aren't a lot of people really interested in it because they already know more about it, or think they know more about it than anybody else. And that it's very difficult to ferret out, you know, the rational from the irrational. So,
with you yourself and other people in your kind of jobs, is there any agreement on some kind of alternative system? And if there is or if there isn't, do you have any access to those ears of power, you know, the political structure, and do they listen?
Yes, lots of alternatives have come forward. None of them have been accepted by the public, and so the politicians don't accept them. We ourselves have not accepted the alternatives.
Are your colleagues in agreement on these kinds of things? I mean, the people who know the most, supposedly, are in agreement on these alternatives?
No. Well, there are basically, simplistically, two sides to this issue. There is the police side, which I will call the paranoid side, and not in a denigrating way. Maybe I should say rather the rigid side, the black and white side, good, bad. And then there is the care and treatment side. And there is this conflict of, we can't have these people doing these kinds of things in our community. And I have had these kinds of things happen to me, and I don't want to have them happen again. Or I don't want my wife, my kid, whatever, you know, raped, maimed, assaulted by these people. And that is very legitimate kind of stuff. Safety issues are very important issues for all of us. The question is, what is safe? And how do you get safety? Do you get safety by locking up 83,000 people in prison who most are going to come out again? 90% of them are going to come out into the community being damaged, already damaged going in there, coming out damaged, and then acting out again. The recidivism rate is, according to anybody's statistics, is somewhere between 50 and 80%. And then the other side of that is these guys go out and convert people to themselves. Are we solving anything by each one teach one?
Talk about recidivism. It seems like this summer or during the past year, I mean, several times I've heard statistics or reports on rehabilitation programs with people who have done fairly severe crimes that seem to be fairly good. Do you know anything? It seems to me one of the things that might be important is good research on this.
We have lots of good research. The sociologists and psychologists have done a lot of good research, and it's all there. But our emotions are blinding us, and for some good reasons. I don't want to be hurt. I don't want my family to be hurt. Neither do you.
There's the research coming out fairly positively.
Research is saying pretty clearly that the number, I mean, and in Vacaville, where I was, I don't know what the other states has. I assume most states have what they call receiving centers. When they go through receiving centers, people are tested. Some of it's just for research, you know. How bright are these people? For a long time, we thought these guys were all dumb. you know, they all got a little like, well, like they fit the bell-shaped curve like any other place. Some of them are dumb, some of them are terribly bright. Most of them are in the middle. You know, what are their educational backgrounds? What are their, you know, what's their family upbringing and all that kind of stuff. And then what works for health? And any one of you already knows what works for health if you're got a family. You know what makes your kids respond and what doesn't. It's human nature. Love. Care. The issue is, are we willing to invest the care in the kids? And if any of you are teachers, you know, by the second grade, you can pick them out. It's that clear. It's that obvious to us. I've never met a teacher who couldn't tell me, you know, by the second grade, we know what kids are going to cause trouble, and we know exactly what's going to happen. We can predict it. Well, why do we spend $14,000 or $25,000 a year when they're 18 years old, and we could spend it when they're 6 and 7? Priorities are not clear there. I mean, there are good reasons for that. Do you have something
else? Well, yes, if our experiment has been such a failure, it seems to me that something should to break this syndrome. You know, what are some of the strong alternatives that you would favor?
Well, if you're going to give anybody any kind of care, you have to have the healthy people outnumber the ill-healthy people. So that means you can't have 35,000 men locked up with 2,000 staff. It won't work. You got to have 3,000 staff for 500 inmates. Or, better yet, you've got to have inmates kept or offenders kept in community placement kind of situations where there are not more than one or two of them or three of them at the most gathered together. And you have full-time staff there in that community setting. Now, the issue that happens is that we don't want people who offend us and who frighten us in our community. So then how do we integrate them into our community? And how do you lower the anxiety and the fear of the community so that they will be willing to accept, so that I will be willing to accept next door to me a home that has three offenders in it with staff there taking care of them? Would you allow that in your neighborhood? That's a simple question. Would you allow that? Would you let them live next door to you?
They stay in my neighborhood. I mean, you're talking about a house. I mean, talking about people who generally don't want to obey a rule. You know, are you talking about putting wires and bars around a house?
No, I'm not talking about doing that. I'm talking about having them live next door as normal human beings with staff who are the monitored, who aren't. We don't have an electric thing around there. We pay somebody $15,000 a year to be monitoring with this people, to walk beside them every minute of the day for 24 hours a day. And we do that for each person that is offended, that offends us. And so we put the money into human resources. And we pay the community then. Instead of all of the money going into a town like Vacaville, we spread the money out so that we hire the psychologists in the towns around Vacaville or wherever these guys offend. We keep them in the town that they live in, and we hire the religious community, the pastors, the psychologists, the grocery store clerks, whatever it is who are going to interrelate with these, and we pay them to be the monitors and the interrelationship with these people so that we keep them right there, and they have to then deal with the community that they offended. Now the other thing that happens is if I offend you in your community, I never have to see you again. I don't have to take any responsibility for what I did. And in fact, I can even benefit from it by stashing the money that I steal from you and picking it up when I come out. I never have to deal with you again, and I get the money to spend. Rather than taking, then if I steal money from you and you they catch me, then you bring me right back in there, and the next question is, well, are you willing to deal with me? Will you talk to me about this? I didn't want to see the people that broke, and I knew who it was. I mean, I could have had access to the person that broke into my car and set it on fire. And I was talking like this then. So you can see the kind of ingrained hostility, the ingrained rejection that we have, or that I have built into myself, or the terror, the hardness it is to deal with somebody who is. And what happens if I know a person, or I've known two, three, or four persons who have had their family killed by somebody, and they have reached out and gone to that person who was killed, their family member, and tried to get some kind of understanding and reconciliation. And then, do we have the resources, and are we willing to put the resources into people who will then be the facilitators for this on both sides? The person who's done the killing and the person who needs the counseling for having been had their family member killed.
Do we have those resources? I mean, this alternative system you're talking about of pastors or community members accepting the people back in their community, is it a, I mean, financially, if we redistributed the money, would there be enough to do that?
Oh, sure. We have more than enough.
So once again, the issue of the public won't accept that, and so politicians won't push it.
The public is you and me. We won't accept it. We won't accept it. It's hard. It's a hard thing to. In the state of California, one time I tried to help the religious community because I was on the state advisory committee and I had access to the broad range of religious community. When I'm talking about religious community, I'm talking about the Muslims and the Jews and all of the whole Protestant thing, including the Scientologists and some other fringe groups, Jehovah's Witnesses and the Mormons. And I said that if every one of the religious communities in the state of California would adopt one inmate, we got more religious communities than we got inmates. Can we do this? Are we willing to do this? And we'll visit them. We'll just, your religious community, Hummer, and it won't be everybody who wants to do it. It'll be people who want to do it. In the church, we'll go and visit one person in there. And then they'll help that family that needs the help, because the family's in all kinds of craziness too. And then we'll help them when they come out, and we'll help them find a job, and we'll give them support. I'm on the board of a foundation that had tried to do this, and we only got one person that was interested, one congregational church that was interested in doing it, and then we couldn't find a match for that. And then we have a group in California called M2. I don't know if any of you have it in your state, but it's where they try to match man to man. And they have tried to do that, to get the churches to it, and they haven't been successful so far either to do it. So it's a very difficult problem.
Well, we still can't accept our halfway houses for the people that do not belong in our state mental institutions. I don't know about California, but Ohio, good Lord, they're always in the courts getting beat because the neighbors do not want these quote crazy people.
Yeah.
Usually not crazy at all. They are efficient a little bit maybe.
Yeah.
But they don't even want that kind of neighborhood. What are you
going to
do if you offer them a couple of bank robbers?
Yeah. And it's, again, it has to do with our ignorance and our fear around this issue. It's very difficult. The statistics, again, say that probably not more than a third of the people that go to prison need to be there. And then now we get into the
What do you mean by need to be there? What does that mean? You said they don't need to be there.
That is that they're, I would say, uncontrollably violent. That's what I would call it. That is, you can't predict what they're going to do, and when they do something, it's violence on somebody. And we can't have that. We can't have people walking around who are going to hit us over the head, or who's going to, you know, stab us and or break into our houses just because they feel like doing that. But that's just a third. So what about the other two thirds? What are they there for? Then that gets under the whole definition. Are any of you lawyers in here? the whole definition of law. What is the law? What's the law say? And what do, and see, because we can define crime as anything we want to. For a long time, in many states, smoking marijuana was not a crime. In other states, smoking marijuana, you got 25 years. See, we can define that. There's a difference between what some of us call street crime and that what some of us would call real crime. Street crime may be defined as an attempt at self-survival. That is, the school system failed those people. The social service system failed those people. The church failed those people. The family failed. The family system failed those people. They're out on the street trying to survive, and so they're stealing, robbing, doing violence as a result of that. There are other people who are mafia style. That's organized crime. There are other people who are, say, Drexel Burnham style, ripping off millions and millions of dollars from the little small people in the world. And that's, you know, who goes to jail? Is Mike going to go to jail for that? You know who Mike Milken is? Milken. Is he going to go to jail for that? You know, he made $500 million in 1 year. Is that crime? Is that a criminal? Is that, you know, what are we going to define as crime, you see? So, the issue is, how do we want to deal with this problem? The Secretary for the Human Resources Agency in the state of California was telling me that, and he was a very conservative man, politician, who was appointed by Governor Brown to run the correctional agency, and he was telling me that the only thing that finally made sense to his friends and the people that he was talking to was the economics. That he could tell them all about, and he was a deacon in the Presbyterian Church. And so he was trying to do some kind of religious commitment to his people he was talking to. And he said, Nick, the only thing that finally ever made sense to any of these people was the economics of it. When I finally told them how much it cost, he said, then they turned around and they said, my gosh, we can't have this happen. But Howard Way has been out of that office for 8 years and we're still doing it. So it really hasn't made sense. I mean, they haven't changed. Or we haven't changed, I should say.
Even economically, I have two questions because it makes no sense to me. One is, if someone does steal, why don't they have to give it back? I mean, why isn't, you know, for the rest of their life, they have to work at it or something?
Right.
And the other one is, isn't there any way that people who've committed crimes or offended society could be made into a situation in which they were either self-supporting or at least contributed to their care more than being sort of wards of the state and being so expensive?
Some states are now doing that. The state of California is, I think, now attaching all Social Security or disabled benefits or veteran benefits. They're just attaching those and taking them.
I just mean, isn't there something they could be doing that generated?
Well, yeah, there is. But we, the public, in many of the states and in the federal system have said, why should those guys be in prison and work and take money away from our plumbers and our people who are trying to get jobs on the outside? You know, we're going to build this $40 million prison over here, and why should those convicts build that thing when, boy, I can get my union in there, and I can get, you know, my people in there, and they should build that thing, and they should get paid for it. And why should the convicts build all the furniture for the state of California when, you know, we can get JCPenney to do it and provide jobs for all those people?
I was listening to a talk show one day, and they had a criminologist on. And he was saying that statistically, as I recall, and you know more about, that's why I'm saying this, more than that, is that the states with the largest percentage of per population, I would assume, I'm not quite sure about this, of prisons cells per population do not necessarily have the lowest crime rates.
No, this has nothing to do with the crime rate.
And the big push is for to build bigger prisons.
That's right.
And the two don't make sense. And, you know, I have a hard time. I realize there's the political pressure, and that's probably what's doing it. But those statistics, for one thing, are not publicized very much, for one thing.
No. Most people are not interested in the prison problem. Most people are, I mean, and for some good reasons, out of fear and out of just, it's, well, so what, that's not my problem.
Well, couldn't they at least get, you know, I don't see much on the economics of the thing in this.
Well, it's coming out more and more now because it's facing us. It's starting to, it's taking money out of all our human resources. It's taking money out of all our educational systems. I mean, it's just, don't have money to do those things anymore. So it's all going into the prison. So people are saying, what do you mean? We, you know, our taxes are going up, but we're not getting better schools. We're not getting better public health care. You know, we're not getting better streets. We're not getting, where's all this money going? I said, well, it's going to the prison system. You just voted on these bonds to build these new prisons. What do you expect? Where do you think that money's coming from? And then you build a prison, and the statistical fact is every time you build a prison, you fill it.
That's right.
So you just, it's just automatic, you automatically fill it.
But another aspect of this is that some responses I've had from people are that, well, we've tried that. We've poured money into social programs in the ghettos and so on, and it didn't work. And then we got into that conservative era, political era, and people just turned off.
Yeah,
right. There used to be a writer for the Los Angeles Times who talked just the way you are about the economics of it, and I tried to talk to college classes about it, but they just closed their ears.
Right.
That's been tried, it didn't work, so forget it, you know, put them in jail.
Right.
And you just could get no further.
That's right. Yeah, it's a fear reaction, and what they say when they say it doesn't work, what they mean is, I'm afraid, and I don't want to be involved in it because if you let those people roam in my community, then I have to become involved, and I don't want to become involved and give my energy and time to that kind of a situation. I can't blame them. I don't want to do it either. You know, I'm glad to be paid to do it. You know, but when I come home at night, I want to watch TV and have a martini and not having anybody throw rocks through my windows.
You mentioned that $50,000 cost for your life termers or your incorrectable people. When I was in Florida, they still had the chain gangs. And I had all kinds of misconceptions about that. I thought that was the world's worst until one day they came and put in a new drain pipe across the Florida State Highway for us. And I had a chance to go over and talk to the two sergeants who had these 12 men, 14 men, one cook and one guy to help the cook and 12 guys to do the digging. And he was telling me that every one of those 12 men or 14 men had murdered someone. He proceeded to tell me the guy that was sharpie and knife cut up his wife one night because they caught her in bed and went right around. And I said, well, what happens when you leave here? He says, well, we got a camp about 20 miles up the road. And all of these men, they were all black, by the way, said all of these men know that if they screw up, they're going back to Rayford. Well, Rayford has the history in the United States of being the worst senior prison you can go to. And I said, what else happens? And he was leaning on his shotgun. He said, they also know that if they step, they run, I'm going to shoot them. And all it takes is one guy to step on a line and for one of us to have to pull the gun because we're on orders not to say we're going to chase you. We're not going to chase you. We're going to go bang, bang. And he says, they have to go pick him up and put him in the truck and then they all go in the bus and they all go back to prison like that. And he said, you know, it sounds inhumane, but he said, I would trust any one of these guys if I didn't have a gun, including the man with the sharpening of the knives to cut the grasses. And he said that they have such a displeasure for Rafer that they'll do anything to stay, not to have to go back there. That once they get into the spirits, he says, they can take a shower when they want there. He says, they can have a radio. They can play cards if they want. They can visit. He said that they got about four groups there, Each group has 14 men. They guard them. They're surrounded. They have a basketball court. He says, it's country club living compared to Rayford. And some of these guys have been doing it for 15 years. He says, they're not happy with it, but it sure beats the alternatives.
Probably cheaper.
And the other thing is, the Florida highways are in pretty good shape because of this manual labor operation.
Yeah.
Then the government came along and said no more.
Yeah, I mean, intimidation and fear works for most of us. Is that what we're about? Is that what we want in our society? So far, we're saying we want that. That, yeah, we want to. If they're going to intimidate us, we're going to intimidate them back.
How do you account for the increase in crime that's just gone, you know, sky high? It seems like crime is on the increase in any large city, you know, particularly in Southern California, you know, in California. Mm-hmm. It's one of our major problems. What do you claim that to be? What's the cause of this? Is it a breakdown in our society, do you think? Or what is it?
Yeah, I can only speculate on that.
Well, I know, but I was wondering.
History says that the societies break down when they lose their reason for being together, and they start investing themselves in material and success models, and they don't invest in one another. And I mean, greed seems to be the motivating factor in the ethos. I mean, the politicians are, you know, they're talking about having now ethics, and they're doing that not because they want to be ethical, but because of the reactions that the public are starting to have because of the unethical things they've done. And basically, it's been greed for power and money, which is a breakdown of human relationships and family. And then, of course, then the definition of the crime. If you define anybody who has half an ounce of marijuana as a criminal, then you go to jail. If you say you got to have 2 ounces of marijuana, then less people go to jail. I'm not advocating one way or the other. I'm just saying the way you define the law is the way you define crime. So.
What about the issue of violence? It seems to someone who doesn't know about it, that violence is really on the rise. Is it for the same reason?
If you're not connected to somebody, it's easier to hit them.
But you said that most people are in families who hit each other. Most people who hit each other are connected.
Murderers. I didn't say. I don't know anything about. Yeah, most murderers are familiar relationships. So.
Isn't there also a relationship between the temperature of the cement and the violence that occurs in a given area?
People say that.
Well,
I don't know.
At least this policeman from Lima said that when it gets hot, he worked down in the south end, which is the poor end. He says, I'll never get back to the station. He says, once I get out there, he said, I'm good for all night long. Between calling ambulances and asking for backup to haul something into the jail, he says, it's just, you get a hot day, you get a couple 90-degree days, look out, it's going to blow. And when it gets cold, he said, it's fun. He says, it's quiet.
Yeah. Again, it points out the disparity of our community. You look at the south end, if that's the bad end, and people down there have violence and on the hot days, and you look at the north end where all the money is and there's no violence up there, what's the difference? How come? Do we want to change that? You know, is that something that we feel important should happen in our community? That we've set up a community so that people in the north end don't hit each other, people in the south end on a hot day hit each other. Do we have some responsibility there to say something's wrong?
Do you have any ideas about what kind of programs would work in these poor and ghetto communities?
Well, when people say that, you know, nothing has worked, my response to that right off hand without knowing anything else about it would be to say, well, how long did you try it?
I know.
You know, most of them wouldn't come up with more than 3 years. 5 years would be an anomaly for sure.
I know. I don't think much has been tried.
You know, so when they say, you know, well, we tried that, I'd say, well, how long did you try it?
And what did you try?
Yeah, and what did you try?
And what was the quality of the attempt?
Right. How much carrying went into it?
Yeah.
How much carrying went into it? And did you just throw money down there? Is that all you did? You just threw money at them? I worked for a Mexican-American job training corporation for about 9 months, and they finally fired me. And those guys were caught on to the American scheme of doing things. You know, the OEO was giving them all this money, and they were out buying Cadillacs and fancy women. And I said, yeah, you're cheating your own people. And they said, well, we don't need you around here any longer. Now, you know, that's what money does. But at least, in one sense, I could say to them, well, at least the money's coming into your community. You see.
I'd like to know, in terms of your own faith, how is it that you relate to or find forgiveness for? I mean, if I were with somebody who had raped my daughter or something, I don't know where I would find the resources to care about them.
Yeah, that's a real, good issue.
How do you? What? How has that worked for you?
I've not had that happen to me personally, so
well,
I can't.
Well, to be with people who have done things that would make you afraid, how do you get to forgiveness?
Try to feel into the men. I cared about the men a lot. Naturally, spontaneously cared about them. I saw them as human beings.
You're talking about the people you're working with?
Yeah, the inmates. The inmates.
Yeah, as long as it's not... I don't work with a lot of people who've committed crimes, but I do every once in a while. It's easy as long as the crime isn't to me personally.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to forgive them and accept them, I think.
I liked a lot of them. I liked Charlie Manson a great deal. And he worked for me for 4 years, and we had a lot of conversations.
What did he do when you say he worked for you?
He was my janitor in the chapel that I had. The issue of forgiveness, it's a very emotional issue for me. And if you want to talk about some of that tomorrow, we can get into that. It's when you bring that up, then you're poking at the heart of me, and as a religious leader, and you're poking at the heart of the church that I belong to as a failure, and you're poking at the heart of the leadership of that church, which is a failure, and then you're poking at all of you that says, do you know how to forgive? Do you want to forgive? Do you want to learn how to forgive? If you do, then maybe the first thing you need to do is say, what is it going to take? And who is my pastor? And does he know how to forgive? If he doesn't know how to forgive, maybe I ought to get out of here. I ought to tell him, if you don't know how to teach forgiveness, so long, Charlie. I'm going someplace else. And it's my experience that we, the leaders of the church, do not know how to forgive. We know how to forgive those people who have offended you. And we know how to talk theologically about forgiveness. And we know all the psychodynamics, or a lot of us know a lot of the psychodynamics about what it means to forgive. But we don't know how to do it. And therefore, we don't know how to teach it.
We just can't forget.
Well, I think it's more than that.
Well, when I hear people talk in the church, and they'll go back 20, 30, 40 years, somebody made a mistake, and it wasn't catastrophic, it was a legitimate mistake. And because they made that mistake, they can never do anything in the church right again. Don't ask them. They made a mistake, and we can tell you all about it if you want to hear. And it's the same thing, I think they carry it over with someone has to go to prison and serve his time. For some reason, we have that group of people who never want to forget. They never want to give up on hammering home to somebody, you made a mistake. Even though society says they served their time, it should be forgotten.
But that's the results. That's not how you do it, you see. How do you teach forgiveness? How does your pastor, or if you're a pastor, how do you teach forgiveness? How do you model it? not talk about it? How do you model forgiveness? And then how do you connect your modeling to Jesus Christ? Or how do you take Jesus Christ into yourself and model that to the people around you? And that's where the rub hits. And the challenge, basically, to the religious community is a forgiveness challenge. If we expect the community around us to forgive the inmates or to come to some rational understanding about not putting so much money into the system, if we're going to be the leaven, then we got to be able to understand how to do it ourselves. And we don't. I don't know how to do that. I'm not standing outside that. I'm saying, I don't know how to do that. I'm here to share my experience with you and tell you what I've experienced and what it's meant to me and how difficult a problem it is. And that it is it's a terrible problem. I don't have answers to give you for this. I just can share what I am and where I've been and how hard it is. Even to the extent that all my years I've been in there, particularly the beginning of the years, my church didn't want to hear anything about it. I belong to the Pacific Southwest Synod of the Lutheran Church in America. And that church at that time is pretty a liberal church in terms of Lutheranism, and it's pretty social conscious and aware and politically active. And they didn't really care too much to hear about it. They started to, and I poked and I shoved, and it wasn't a hostile word. It was just ignoring. And so it's not uncommon that people don't want to hear about it. It's not uncommon that people don't want to get involved. It's a terribly, terribly difficult issue. It's five after.
Were you here for Matt this morning?
No, I wasn't.
Okay. Yeah. What she was really pointing out is that you have to be able to put yourself in the place of the person who committed the crime, not only the person who was that the crime was committed on. Mm-hmm. And I think for most of us, there is a situation, there is a possibility of any of us being able to commit any kind of a crime if the situation is bad enough. But we don't want to recognize that. So we don't want to understand these other people that commit crimes. Because then we are opening ourselves up to the idea that we could possibly be that same person that did that terrible thing.
There is some truth to that, but there's also a whole lot of fallacy to that.
Oh, I suppose.
It doesn't take one. It doesn't take one to cure one. It doesn't take one to understand one. You see, so that the difference between, and that's part of the fallacy of our law, and part of the fallacy of our understanding what prisons are all about. We think the people in prison react and understand life and see life the same way we do. We get into the dynamics of what's a sociopath, what's a psychopath. They're not like us, unless you are one of them. And that Norman Mailer has said the United States is a country of sociopaths.